But it's been fascinating, hasn't it, to discover so many lessons of life. If we take God out of the equation, what are we left with? Well, here we discover something, again, which is quite fascinating, I think, even though at first glance these series of proverbs seem to be quite hard to put together. I think they do work. Let me say, it seems to me no one ever set out in life to be mediocre. No one ever aimed to be nothing more than average. No one ever dreamed about being ordinary. Now, if we think about it, none of us would like the sort of inscription on our grave that read, "Here lies Paul Williams, an average husband, ordinary father, not a bad sort of friend, and a pretty average Christian. May he rest in mediocrity." None of us ever set out in life with that sort of aim, but strangely, that is what many people settle for. Have you noticed that? In the end, at retirement, millions of people end up being content with having had an average career, living in an average house with an average 2.5 children and an average car to drive around in. They'd never say that was their aim in life, but when push comes to shove, that's what they've settled for. And today's passage, I think, helps us to see why. See, as we've seen over these last weeks, the author of this book, the teacher as he calls himself, has set out to find the meaning of life on planet Earth. And crucially, as we read Ecclesiastes, those are the parameters. Life on Earth, as he describes it, life under the sun. That's an expression that if you've been here week after week, we've seen him use over and over. Life below the clouds, without God involved. Of course he believes that there is a God, but he's not really involved in life. Is there meaning in life if we largely take God out of the equation? That's his question. His research to find the meaning of life in this world has, for the past 6.5 chapters, drawn the same conclusion. Look at life under the sun and it's meaningless, and today's passage is no exception. Look at verse 15 again that we just had read for us of Ecclesiastes 7. In this meaningless life of mine, I've seen both of these, a righteous man perishing in his righteousness and a wicked man living long in his wickedness. It's a conundrum in life, isn't it? It's a question I've been asked on more than one occasion from both believers and unbelievers. Why is life so unfair? Do you see it there in verse 15? Why do bad things happen to good people and, at the same time, good things happen to bad people? Why, verse 15, do the good die young while others get away with murder? It was, of course, one of the many questions thrown up by the tragic events of September the 11th. Good people died that day. While some of the key perpetrators of the attacks not only appear to have got away with murder, but they've actually prospered. They are now heroes in their own world. They are the untouchables in their own communities. They've prospered. Now, those injustices bother us, and rightly so. And those injustices, says the teacher, when you take God out of the equation, render life pretty meaningless. Because those injustices mean that life is a lottery. Life's just a game of chance. And when life is just a game of chance, when the good people die young and bad people seem to prosper sometimes, when life is just a game of chance like that, then does it matter how you play the game? On Saturday night, my wife and I were playing a board game called Settlers of Catan. Sad, isn't it? That's what life has been reduced to for my wife and I. We live in the centre of one of the most happening cities in the world, and we play board games on Saturday night. Well, anyway, that's my problem, not yours. But quite understandably, by the end of the game, Caroline was pretty frustrated. "You are so lucky," she said. Well, to a certain extent, Settlers of Catan is a game of strategy. But it doesn't matter how good your strategy is. If the dice are against you, there's no way you'll win. And I have to say, it wouldn't have mattered how Caroline had played or how rubbish my strategy had been. I'd have won the game on Saturday night. I was so lucky with the dice. Now, at the end of a Saturday night playing Settlers of Catan, it might seem a bit peeving to be on the wrong end of the dice, but quite frankly, it doesn't matter too much. But when we're talking about life itself, when even if you play a good life, you end up perishing, well, then does it matter how you play? Especially when others have played a bad life and they actually do very well. You see, verse 15 renders life pretty meaningless, doesn't it? That's the conclusion when you take God out of the equation. And so when life appears to be a lottery, we actually end up settling for mediocrity. Look at what he goes on to say in verse 16. Don't be overrighteous, neither be overwise. Why destroy yourself? See that off the back of verse 15? If people who have desperately tried to be good and then they die young, he says, what's the point of trying to do the right thing in your life? I mean, it's hard work, isn't it? It takes effort to give a good, to live a good life. Why destroy yourself trying to be a good person, says the teacher in verse 16. Well, he doesn't go to the other extreme either. See verse 17, don't be over wicked either. Don't run around like English football fans after the national team have been defeated. Don't be a fool, verse 17. Don't be a complete hooligan. Because while it's sometimes the case, as we saw in verse 15, that good things happen to bad people, there's no guarantee of that either. So don't be over righteous. Don't be over wicked. When life is random, well then, the end of verse 18, avoid all extremes. That's his advice. All things in moderation. That's the moral motto when life is random. It's what parents love to tell their children. It's what I was told when I was growing up. Don't go to extremes. Have no excesses and you'll be all right. Seems wise, doesn't it? And don't forget to have a little religion thrown in, by the way, he says. You see, there, and I think that's the point of the last phrase in verse 18. The man who fears God will avoid all extremes. Here, of course, is the thought of many today. Treat God as an indemnity clause. Have a bit of religion in your life, just in case it turns out that God is there and he does care and he is involved. Well, again, that's how many people live life. At the last church that I was involved in, the first time that I often met people was when they wanted their baby baptized. Never been involved in church, they had a baby, they wanted the baby done. No intention of being involved in the church in the future. They had a sort of spiritual superstition. And as I would sort of ask them about why they wanted their baby done, they'd say something like, well, you know, we kind of want the baby to be protected. Maybe, even though we're not living it out, maybe God is there. They weren't going to go to any extremes, though. They weren't going to take Jesus too seriously. They were going to treat God like a life jacket on an airline. We went to Spain a couple of weeks ago, and I was reminded of all that the air stewardesses say as they stood in front of us in case there is an emergency, in the unlikely event of an emergency. Locate the exits here, here, and here. Oxygen masks will fall from your head, from above your head. Adults should fit their own before trying to help children. And under your seat, you will find a life jacket. Well, that would do a great amount of good, wouldn't it? 30,000 feet up in the air, a life jacket. That will help me to bounce, will it, when I hit the ground, perhaps? Now, to most people, God is a bit like a life jacket on an aeroplane. You've got a life jacket, but you know you'd rather have a parachute. But still, to have a life jacket is better than nothing. So, like God, you hope you'll never have to use it, but it's just nice to know it's there all the same. Now that has to be, I think, the point of the end of verse 18. The man who fears God will avoid all extremes. Have a bit of religion up your sleeve, just in case. But don't go to extremes. See, this isn't actually the Bible's advice. We've got to remember the context here. He's looking at life under the sun as if God were not involved. So we don't for one minute think that the end of verse 18 is actually authentic Christian living. Because authentic Christian living is being completely extreme, isn't it? 100% sold out for Jesus Christ. Wholehearted in serving the living God. It's full on for him. As somebody said to me when I worked in the newspaper business, you're completely into this Christian thing, aren't you? And before I had a chance to reply, another colleague replied, if he was any further into it, he'd be coming out the other side. Now, I thought that was a great compliment. I'm glad that's how they saw it. But what the teacher is saying here is when life seems to be a lottery, when God actually isn't really involved, then verse 18, don't take anything too extreme. Don't go too far. Have a bit of religion, just as a fallback position. Avoid all moral extremes. Moderation in all things. That's the advice. And he says the same thing in verses 19 to 22. See, he says, verse 19, wisdom is no bad thing. Wisdom makes one wise man more powerful than 10 rulers in a city. Having a truly wise person in the government stands out a mile, he says. It's a good thing. Wisdom is no bad thing, but don't go to extremes over wisdom. After all, verse 20, there's not a righteous man on earth who does what is right and never sins. Don't bust a gut trying to be the wisest person on the planet, because we're never going to be totally righteous. And verses 21 and 22 confirm that as well, don't they? Look at verse 21. Do not pay attention to every word people say, or you may hear your servant cursing you. For you know in your heart that many times you yourself have cursed others. See, he says, listen at keyholes and you may hear something unfortunate about yourself. People aren't very righteous, you see. Even those you employ, those you're paying money to, they may speak badly about you, verse 21, but don't be shocked if they do, because you know you've done it to others, verse 22. And that's the truth, isn't it? We're always shocked when people speak badly of us. We just conveniently forget that we've done it to others. So you see, verses 19, 20, 21, 22, it's all saying the same sort of thing. Wisdom is good, verse 19, but don't try and be the most wise person who ever lived, because that's not possible, verse 20. So again, it's moderation in everything, because life is so random. There's no point aiming for something too grand if it doesn't come about, because you might get struck down in a moment. Can't control your destiny. Yes, have a bit of common sense. After all, it won't do you any harm and it might get you a long way in life. Sort of aim to be comfortable. Nothing spectacular. Settle for a stress-free life. That would probably be a good aim in life, wouldn't it? Keep your head. Don't do anything too wild. That's the advice, you see, if life is just a game of chance. And of course, actually, that's the way, if we look around us and we'll open our eyes, most people do live life. But are you really satisfied with that? I mean, this is the search for the meaning in life. If you're going to just conclude that life is about being mediocre, average, doing nothing very spectacular, are you really prepared to conclude that that's what life is all about? Well, the teacher isn't. He's deeply dissatisfied with the shallowness of being ordinary. So, verse 23, he said, I'm determined to find wisdom. I'm determined to find the meaning in life. Well, no wonder. Who wants to reduce life to getting through to the end? But actually, a lot of people do. The problem is that even when he suddenly becomes determined to find wisdom, he realizes that this search soon grinds him down. See, I'm determined to be wise, in verse 23, soon turns to, but this was beyond me. It's tiring to be searching and searching for something and never really getting to the bottom of things. Maybe you've come here as an unbeliever and you're searching for the meaning of life. We're thrilled you've come. Maybe you're a bit tired of this search because you can't find where it's all leading to. See, the question of life at first can be something of a stimulus. By the end, it wears us down, he says in verse 23. That's why most people do end up concluding that life is nothing much more than being mediocre. That's why many achieve so little and are so happy at aiming for nothing more than, well, a little retirement cottage in the country for a few measly years when we're not really fit enough to enjoy the countryside anyway. But it's pathetic if that's what life is about. Have you seen it in people in their late 30s and early 40s? I'm sure this is part of the middle age crisis, which incidentally I'm hitting at the moment. I mean, I don't know, I'm going through a crisis, but I'm 40 this year, so I'm speaking to myself. But you know, as you see students who are in their late teens and early 20s with such high ideals, principles that they would never sell out on, bright hopes for making something of life, by their late 30s and early 40s, those principles have become unrealistic expectations. They're tired of just going for it, fed up with aiming high when life is so random. They've aimed for things and they've never come about. No point in trying anymore. Mediocrity reigns. Tired of looking for meaning in life because it seems so elusive. You see, that's verse 24. Whatever wisdom may be, it is far off and most profound. Who can discover it? Wisdom, the meaning of life. It does seem far off when you're looking in the wrong place. See, in our house, if you ever come, and you're welcome to come to our house, you will regularly hear a muffled shout from yours truly to my wife. It's muffled because I've usually got my head stuck in a cupboard. Caroline, where's the vacuum cleaner? Caroline, where's the jam? Caroline, where are the girl's shoes? Well, one reason why I can't find these basic household objects is because I'm looking in the wrong place usually. I ought to know where the vacuum cleaner is by now, really, I suppose. But in the case of the jam, I regularly can't find the jam because I've decided that it's on the bottom shelf. I'm in the right cupboard, but it's on the bottom shelf, and it's not. It's on the shelf above. And so it's almost right in front of my nose. It is right in front of my nose. I still can't see it. Has that happened to you? Is that... I think it's a man thing, isn't it, really? Who knows? But I can't see it because I've decided it's not there. That is why so often people don't find meaning in life. They're looking in the wrong place, or even if they're close to looking in the right place, actually they've already decided that meaning of life is not in Jesus Christ. Life itself doesn't help us to find wisdom either, says the writer here, the teacher. He says there are all manner of obstacles in life to stop us actually finding this meaning. That's why, verse 26, the teacher finds more bitter than death the woman who's a snare, whose heart is a trap and whose hands are chains. So he's saying, as you're going through life looking for meaning in life, there are going to be things that take you away. And the Proverbs, of course, are full of this particular problem of the young man deflected from looking for wisdom, looking for Jesus Christ, deflected by the lure of the temptress. Well, if you're taking notes, have a look at Proverbs chapter 2. And Proverbs chapter 6 and Proverbs chapter 7. It's kind of devastating reading, but kind of fun as well. But that is the point of verse 26 of chapter 7 of Ecclesiastes. The temptress is a snare to finding wisdom. She'll take you away. But then, hey, it's not just the temptress. All other human beings aren't a lot of good either. That's what he says in verse 28. He says, while I was still searching but not finding, I found one upright man among 1,000, but not one upright woman among them all. Now, look, I know that women find that verse very annoying. But look, before we get a bit hot under the collar, two things have to be said of this verse. First, no one comes out well. I mean, it's not just a slight on women, is it? I found one upright man among 1,000. He's not a great ratio when it comes to men either, is it? His point is obvious. You're not going to find the answer to the meaning of life in man or woman. You've got to ask an awful lot of people to find out the answer. Second, and I think this is the most important thing to remember, he's not dogmatizing here, but reporting. This is his experience. He's not saying, oh, you actually find a better ratio of men who've actually got some wisdom. No. He's just saying that's his experience. Why? Well, I wonder who the one man was who he found was upright. Well, if this is Solomon, he's probably referring to his father, King David, a man after God's own heart, we read. The only reason Solomon found one upright man was because his dad was that upright man. Otherwise, he'd have said, I didn't find one upright man among 1,000 either. The main point is clear of verses 26 to 28. We won't find wisdom in other people, whether it be somebody obvious like the temptress pulling us away, or actually just ordinary people. You can ask them forever. And incidentally, that's not God's fault. Look at verse 29. This only have I found. God made mankind upright, but men have gone in search of many schemes. Yeah, God did make the world good, but we decided to go our own way. Well, how are we to conclude in all of this then? Are we just going to conclude life is meaningless? Are we going to go down this route of, in the end, just being mediocre? Life is so random, there's not really a lot of point in me really going for it, because it might come to nothing anyway. Is that what we're going to decide? Is that the way our life is going? Is that what we're heading for? Whether we're unbelievers or Christians. Actually, Christians can easily end up just looking for mediocrity and being happy with being nothing out of the blue. Well, I'm going to conclude by reading from Derek Tidball and his commentary on Ecclesiastes. He says, we do not have it within ourselves to be wise. There is an inbuilt bias towards foolishness. But what we cannot be ourselves, we can be through faith in Jesus. We need to accept his forgiveness for our foolishness, and that frees us from the follies of the past. We can make him Lord, which gives us a new pattern of wisdom to follow. We can ask him to take over our lives, and that means he'll give us his Spirit's ability to live wisely. What we are not capable of ourselves, we can receive from Christ, who longs to make us wise. Our world has never known so much or been so intelligent, but where has it got us? Sad faces, hardened people, damaged lives and broken homes, disintegrating societies and nations at war are the order of the day, all because we have the knowledge but not the wisdom that we need. Wisdom, Jesus Christ, would make a real difference to us, not just a cosmetic change. All we need to do is humbly to accept God's offer of wisdom in Jesus. But there's the stumbling block. It's hard to admit that we've not got it within ourselves. We find it difficult to ask for help from outside. But if we do not, wisdom will remain elusive. That's the teacher's experience as he looks for the meaning in life, having cut God out of the equation. Doesn't matter where he looks, he can't find it. And that is the most frustrating life. You either give up looking, probably because it wears you down, or you'll eventually find it in Jesus. And if you give up looking, you just end up leading a mediocre life. I don't want that. I'm sure you don't either. So he says, look for it in Jesus. That's what the Proverbs tell us.